Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. If you are just joining us, this is part two of today's clinical focus, which is a discussion of the op-ed written this week by celebrated vegan proponent Dr. Dean Ornish. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times entitled "The Myth of High-Protein Diets." And I guess it came out in a Sunday edition of the Times on the, I believe it was the 23rd. So that's actually the Monday edition of the New York Times. And it's created quite a stir. There's been a lot of blowback already in the letters, in the comments section. So continuing, Dean Ornish also writes that animal protein increases IGF-1. And this interesting theory is that IGF-1 is an insulin-like growth factor, and insulin-like growth factor is associated with the proliferation of cancer. It is particularly associated with prostate cancer and possibly breast cancer, possibly other cancers. It's a growth hormone. Now, one of the reasons why I am not a big advocate of growth hormone, this is a parenthetical comment, is because IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, is associated with cancer. So why would you want to take something as an anti-aging or a longevity thing that increases your growth hormone? That's problematic, and I do have concerns about if you have a potential for developing cancer, you're taking growth hormone, that could fan the flames of cancer growth or metastasis. But leaving that issue aside, does animal protein increase IGF-1? And the answer is yes. But IGF-1 is one of those things that's, it's kind of a push-pull thing. Is yes, it promotes cancer, but it's also something that promotes organ regeneration. It promotes vitality. One of the reasons why weightlifters take growth hormone is because it increases muscle size and strength. So, all right, you may get, I'm not even entirely sure that all the research linking animal protein to IGF-1 is conclusive, but let's say you completely eliminate animal protein, you're going to drop your levels of IGF-1. There are other detrimental health consequences such as osteoporosis, weakness, sarcopenia, or loss of muscle mass that might occur. Now, what's also interesting about the study, I looked at that study, and what was interesting is that you actually get a reverse effect. Once again, after 65, you actually want more IGF-1 because it's going to offset some of the effects of aging. So there was actually a reduction in health problems associated with these cancers in individuals who consumed more animal protein later in life. And again, we have to separate out, people who consume animal protein, that's also a marker for just overall caloric intake. As an aside, when I was a young practitioner and I was across town from Dr. Atkins, and Dr. Atkins was recommending the Atkins diet, and I began to recognize there really was something to it. However, I saw all too many patients using the Atkins diet as a way to legitimize their bon vivant lifestyle. They wanted to eat their steak and lobster and throw lots and lots of butter on their food and have lots of cheese fondue. This is actually when Atkins got started, it was the year of the cheese fondue. So, lots and lots and lots of fat. And I said, my interpretation of that was the Atkins diet can work. It can help to lose weight. You eat a lot of fat, you get early satiety, you can go into ketosis, weight goes down. But I said, it's also true that a samurai, a very, very highly sharpened samurai sword gives you the best shave in the world. All right, you're following this analogy? But it has to be wielded with great precision, the samurai sword, because if you don't wield it with great precision, there's a high margin for error, and you can cut your jugular vein or slice your head off. And that's the same thing with a very high protein, high fat diet. You cannot just say, well, I'm going to have a lot of protein and fat and then continue to eat the same amount of carbohydrates. The carbohydrates ignite the fat and the protein into cardiovascular risk, cancer risk, diabetes risk, fat deposition, obesity. So you can't have it both ways. I think that's part of the reasons why these studies looking at people consuming lots of meat show statistically some problems. Okay. Now, he also writes, to summarize, Dean Ornish writes, an optimal diet for preventing disease is a whole foods, plant-based diet. I agree so far. But then this is what I disagree with. That is naturally low in animal protein. I agree about the whole foods, plant-based. Get a lot of, you know, beans and lots of vegetables and fruits. Not too, you know, sugary fruits. Not a lot of fruit juice. And avoid the ones that are sort of artificially bred and pumped up with sugar. He also says the diet would be naturally low in harmful fats and refined carbohydrates. I'm down with that. I'm down with that. I agree so far. What that means in practice is little or no red meat. Disagree. Mostly vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, and soy products in their natural forms. Very few simple and refined carbohydrates such as sugar and white flour. I agree there. And sufficient good fats such as fish oil or flax oil, seeds, and nuts. That's funny because he still wants to stick to his vegetarian, you know, vegan creed. So he says, have fish oil. But how are you going to have fish oil without the fish? He says, don't eat the fish, have the fish oil. This is actually a modification of his thinking because he used to say, don't have any fat at all. Have very minimal fat. Now he says, you need some omega-3. This is actually coming around to the notion that you need some omega-3 and some healthy fats. So have some sufficient good fats, such as fish oil or flax oil, seeds, and nuts. I notice he doesn't say olive oil, which is a very beneficial fat. That's not included in his program, possibly. And a healthful diet should be low in bad fats, meaning trans fats, agreed, saturated fats, disagree, and hydrogenated fats, disagree. That's the same as trans fats. All right. Now, he points to the research that he did. He says, he's at a nonprofit, the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, and he works with the University of California, San Francisco. And he has conducted clinical research proving the many benefits of a whole foods, plant-based diet on reversing chronic diseases. Our interventions also include stress management techniques, moderate exercise like walking, and social support. Well, the problem with these studies is this is a multiple intervention study. Not just a vegetarian diet, which, by the way, is a much lower calorie diet overall. It's a restrictive diet. So it really puts a block between you and the refrigerator or you and the fast food eatery. You're going to be eating whole foods, natural foods, and less of them. And there's going to be a lot of fiber, and you're going to chew and chew and chew, and you're going to achieve a lot of satiety. So if you can do that, God bless you. But it's hard. And then there was also a lot of meditation, relaxation, social support, hand-holding. And so he says in the article, episodes of chest pain decreased by 91% after only a few weeks. Well, I got to say, you know, you see chest pain being reduced by 91% after a few weeks. That's not that the arteries are opening up. That's just that the stress levels are abating and maybe there's a placebo effect. So I'm not that impressed with that as a sign of reversal. However, I will give him credit because he did show in a study after 5 years, that there was actually a discernible improvement in coronary blood flow. And he did, you know, this takes a lot of organization and effort and money to perform the studies that show that lifestyle interventions can actually improve coronary blood flow. So kudos to Dr. Ornish for performing these studies. But this was the result of some exceptional individuals, a small handful of them, undertaking a real life transformation, not just with diet, but with multiple risk factor reduction, stress reduction, exercise, meditation, social support, and so on. And no vitamins, because he doesn't believe in vitamins. Okay, so that basically sums it up. So he says, oh, here, this is important too, because this is actually commonly used as a rationale for a vegetarian diet. He says, in addition to what's good for you is good for our planet. Livestock production causes more disruption of the climate than all forms of transportation combined. And because it takes as much as 10 times more grain to produce the same amount of calories through livestock as through direct grain consumption, eating a plant-based diet could free up resources for the hungry. Okay, so what he's saying here is, like, even though you're going through some deprivation, it's good for you and it's good for the planet. And we as citizens of the planet, you know, this is an ecological argument that, you know, don't be selfish, don't eat meat, because meat requires a lot of energy for production. It increases your carbon footprint. It's, you know, if you drive a Prius, you know, you shouldn't be eating a 22-ounce sirloin steak, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it appealed to the ecologically minded. And now with global warming thrown in, you know, there's even more urgency to protecting the climate. What I would say about that is, let's put aside for the moment the truth of that statement that eating a vegetarian diet is better for the planet than eating a meat diet. Let's just pull that one in abeyance. It's a little unfair, I think, to hook a scientific argument about the health merits of a diet to an ecological argument. So let's say, for example, that it was documented that it would be better for the planet if humans ate insects, and it was also very healthy. It would be, because we would, you know, cut down on our insects. You know, we'd eat up, you know, all the flies, and, you know, all of, you know, we would you know, eat you know, some of these harmful creatures in our environment. And at the same time, it would confer health benefits because whatever. Would that be a fair way to hook in the argument that humans should subsist on insects? I mean, I'm giving you kind of an absurd argument here, but another way to put it is, let's say that meat really is healthy and essential for some people to eat. Are we going to then say, hey, in the spirit of environmental integrity, we're going to deprive you of access to meat? We're going to put an exorbitant tax on it. We're going to make it illegal to have more than a certain amount of meat. We know it's good for you and certain people depend upon it for health, but because of the planet, we're going to restrict access to it. I mean, that's actually, to some extent, what it's coming down to, because, you know, they really want to penalize you know, people who, you know, the coal miners, the frackers, the gas producers, the oil well drillers, because, you know, while it's great for people to get cheap gas, it's bad for the planet. So they're saying, in effect, what they're saying is, let's make an ecological argument for how we should eat. And I'm not debating the merits of the morality of that. I'm just saying, does that somehow make meat bad to eat? You're conflating the arguments. That's all I'm saying. And that this is a point that's been made by, more eloquently than me, by Nicolet Hahn-Nyman, who I interviewed recently in a book called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Now, I'll point out another thing, because I said, let's hold in abeyance the notion that it's more ecological to eat grains than to eat meat. Would it surprise you if I told you that based on recent scientific studies, that consumption of lots of plant foods, not necessarily grains, because grains are fed to animals and you have to feed a lot of grains to make an animal. But it actually turns out that in terms of water management and resource management, land management, that making plants can actually be more ecologically costly than raising beef. This is quite surprising, especially if you use a sustainable model of beef production, which is not the factory farm model, but more of a grazing model where you actually kind of go back to the way beef and cattle were raised on the prairie in a more natural way, sustaining the cycle of growth of the grass and maintaining an environmental ecosystem in which cattle were part of the ecosystem. When we push the cattle off the range and into factory farms, and introduced fields where we grow lots of wheat and corn. By the way, you know, lots of the corn goes into gasoline, or it goes into sugar products, and it does go into animal feed, but a lot of it goes right into our gullets or into our cars. And that's a very expensive and water-hungry form of agriculture. It also requires a lot of fertilizers and nutrients. But let's say, you know, the organic kale that you get, you know, that's it takes a lot of land and water. You know, the fruits that you get, the fresh fruits that arrive at your factory table, I mean, at your urban table in Minneapolis or in Boston in the month of February when it's nothing grows here, just to bring it and transport it is very, very energy intense. And so the argument could be made that, you know, these people who are perhaps feeling self-righteous that they're consuming low on the food chain, that they actually may be utilizing a lot of environmental resources that are involved in watering, fertilizing, and transporting these foods, which must be transported, you know, fresh. I mean, think of a berry that comes to you, and, you know, I pay a fortune for berries, fresh berries that come to me because they're put on a jet plane from God knows where, you know, Honduras or Guatemala, to my kitchen table here in Manhattan, and they have to be transported in an energy intense way. So just saying, you know, this environmental argument is, I think, it's always appended to the food argument. And it's sort of like, you know, if you, you know, if you're teetering on the brink and you're a good person, think, you know, not think beyond yourself, think altruistically, because it's going to, you know, affect the balance, the balance of the planet is, I mean, the future of the planet hangs in the balance, and you can tilt it one way or another by making the right food choices for you and your family. It's a little more complex than that, and I think the counter-argument is worth hearing, because we make simplistic arguments about energy-saving things like our Prius cars, which require mining for rare earths that's very energy intense and requires use of electricity, which comes from somewhere. It's sometimes things that on the surface appear environmentally friendly may have hidden environmental costs. That's all I'm saying. You know, clearly, you know, the way that, you know, factory beef production in America is very energy wasteful, very polluting, and very inhumane. But there may be a case to be made for a healthier agriculture where animal protein is incorporated, healthier forms of animal protein. They're not laced with antibiotics, that are not laced with, that are not full of toxins, that are not full of hormones, and that actually are fed healthier feed that results in their fat composition being less harmful to us. You know, the argument, unfortunately, that is not seen by Dean Ornish is he indicts meat altogether. I think one of the worst aspects of meat is that it's modern meat, and that modern meat is, it's not you are what you eat, it's you are what you eat eats. And when you eat meat that is fed corn, the marbling of the fat in the meat, by the way, they encourage the marbling by, you know, having the animals exercise less, they crowd them into pens and they don't move around. So there are obese animals that are marbled with fat that comes from omega-6 sources. So instead of getting omega-3, which you would get if the animals were grass-fed on the prairie, as they have for so many centuries, you're getting animals that are artificially plumped up. And by the way, that may be one of the best arguments for avoiding meat, is the meat quality is poor in America. And so thereby, you can enhance your health by eating less meat altogether. But now, fortunately, it's not inherent in animal protein that is bad for you, because we've seen so many anthropological studies and the studies of primitive tribes, and also looking at the fossil evidence, showing that tribes and cultures which subsisted on large amounts of animal protein actually weren't unhealthy. They didn't have cardiovascular disease, cancer. It was not contributory to high risk. So I'll just share with you a couple of comments that I think are particularly astute from the readers to this Dean Ornish op-ed. Daniel from Washington, D.C. writes, I finally got my triglycerides under control by moving to a very low-carbohydrate diet. After 3 months on the low-carb diet alone, my triglycerides dropped by half, despite previously having been eating low-fat, lots of whole grains. And then he adds, my father died while trying to adhere to the Ornish diet. So that's not a sterling recommendation for the Ornish diet. Here's another one. This is from Gigi in New Windsor, New York. I have attempted the plant-based approach and gained weight. I ate whole grains, tofu, no meat at all, and felt miserable, and my blood work was terrible. Then I tried the Atkins approach. My blood work came back way better. I actually ate less and was better able to maintain weight. Ask anyone in the gym who looks fit what they eat, and they will tell you. Animal protein and veggies. Sorry, doc. My personal experience does not bear out your findings. Perhaps someone without bias should conduct a truly unbiased study. Okay, so let's some more responses. Victor from Lexington, Mass. writes, chest pain reduced within weeks certainly sounds like a powerful placebo effect. Coming to a comment by Ray in Massachusetts, Dr. Ornish, Ansel Keys, and countless other members of the nutrition establishment have been promoting low-fat diets for nearly 50 years. They've promoted this type of lifestyle, yet Americans have been getting fatter and fatter. The scientific rigor of their studies has been questioned time and time again. Ornish, for instance, has countless confounding variables and a ridiculously small sample size in his studies. Gary Taub's article in the New York Times was a groundbreaking one in pointing out the fallacies associated with a low-fat diet. Research the issue and you'll find that the science does not support the claims of Ornish. Better yet, do a self-study and go on a diet that is comprised of 80% fat, 10% protein, and 10% carbohydrate. What you will see is that your blood glucose levels will be in a healthy range, your triglycerides will drop dramatically, and your HDL will rise. You will lose weight and feel better. So people are quite incensed. Within hours, they were writing all kinds of blowback. This one says, when I was 48, my loving wife took meat out of our diet. In 2 years, I gained 45 pounds, partly because I was a continuous carbohydrate insulin cycle and was shortly diagnosed as type 2 diabetic. I have since reduced my consumption of simple carbs, eating no sugar, no white potatoes, very limited refined grains, all replaced with 100% whole grain, 7-grain or 12-grain bread in limited amounts, butter oil mixed in limited amounts, and meat in modest-sized servings. I have painlessly lost 50 pounds at a rate of 3 to 5 pounds per year, and my blood sugar is well managed. Okay, so that's a guy with a mixed diet response, but people, for some people, this Ornish diet backfires. And this comment here from, let's see, we get another comment in. One person writes, Dr. Ornish has made outstanding contributions to preventive medicine and health science. So there's a pro, Dean Ornish. This person writes, the bottom line, though, is that there are societies that eat diets very high in animal fat and saturated fat and have very low rates of heart disease and cancer risk. Meat and fat just aren't what's doing this. When you drop the phony science, you realize that we don't know very much at all, and that the little we do know doesn't support the bizarre and unpalatable diet that Dr. Ornish recommends, which departs radically from the diet we evolved to eat at a time when there were no refined grains or added sugars. Jim from Boynton Beach writes about Dr. Ornish. His whole history in this field is now in question. He's still going with eggs as the bogeyman and fat makes you fat. That's the kind of advice that made us the fattest group of people on the planet. That's a fairly typical response. Another person writes about selective findings to bolster a thesis. Another person, thoughtful comment from Teresa in Los Angeles. She's an RN. Some thought needs to be given to the fact that because of our difference as far as ancestral backgrounds, our needs are not the same. We now know that genes are turned on and off, epigenetics by a mechanism, which is becoming better understood. And so she argues for individualization of diets based on genetic typing. That's referred to as nutrigenomics, a science which is in its infancy, but eventually will be perfected. Augustus from Lonesome Dove, Texas, writes, the studies I've seen that conclude red meat and fat is bad don't simultaneously control carbohydrate intake. This is a fatal experimental flaw because we know that fat plus carbs result in bad type blood cholesterol. And Tom from the Midwest writes, our main problem with all the anti-meat studies is the source of the meat, and little is done to analyze the meat. Barbara from Cleveland, she's a physician specializing in obesity, and she writes, research on dietary elements is generally flawed because it's extremely difficult to get right. Why? It relies on dietary recall, looks at enormous populations, and has way too many confounding variables. She writes, America seems bent on veering wildly from one diet style to another, high fat, low carb. Discussions like these are not particularly useful, and no one knows how to eat or who to believe. Dietary guidelines released by the government have been just as flawed as the dietary studies we love to quote. And so she says, when it comes to eating, a simple philosophy, easy to follow, works best. Your diet is probably working fine for you if you are at reasonable rate, have normal blood pressure, and have normal lipids and blood sugar. And that's kind of a reasonable approach to take. So there you have it. I wanted to provide you with some instantaneous analysis and response to a timely issue, which is Dean Ornish's article. And I hope that you found this edifying. We'd love to hear your comments. Write us to radioprogram@AOL.com. And if you have a question, we'll be happy to answer it on our weekly Q&A with Layla Session. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.